Okay. A couple of perspectives on relaxing selfing. And I'm sort of bringing some of the guided meditation practices, which, as somebody pointed out, very true, we're a lot about doing. And what I will try to do in terms of the meditation is take the Austin's work and do a little bit more of being. So we'll spend about 30 minutes being in hopefully an allocentric space. And I'm going to beg your indulgence, first time I've done this meditation, and we're going to change sensory systems to the hearing, because doing it in the visual system is a little too hard. So we'll try for an allocentric auditory meditation. Let's see if it works. So relaxing selfing. The first phrase there, you need a coherence of person to relax selfing. These are just a few little kind of caveats and things to take with you out into the world as you play with this whole concept of big S self, pun intended again, and small self. I've had a number of people come up and talk to me today who had questions about, I'm on medication, or I have migraine, or I've had a stroke, and I think one of the things I need to be very careful about in this is that you have to live with the brain that you have, and that we set this talk up basically on kind of an assumption that we're talking to people whose brains do not have injury. That's actually a tough one in many ways, because most of us come from childhood with, childhood injuries and experiences that left us scarred in this way or the other. We come through adolescence, and there are people who have abuse issues and drug issues and alcohol issues. And so there are things that happen to the brain as we get older. As a neurologist, I see a lot of, when we start looking at MRI scans of people in their 40s, we start seeing these little, what we call unidentified bright objects, these little tiny areas of small scar where a little tiny arteriole has become plugged up. And it's gradual accumulation of little tiny vascular insults and strokes that starts about the age of 45 and progresses on until you pass away. So I'm now 61. Going to be 62 in February, and so I am now somewhat more nervous about putting my head in an MRI scanner, thinking about all the little white spots I'm going to see in my own brain. But the whole idea of taking these practices of taking in the good and doing this sort of doing work of setting up how to hold yourself in compassion, or how to hold this selfing process in compassion and with care, is going to establish a level of coherence that will allow you to relax the self, that will allow that self that's been around there and helped you get through your life to a great extent. Because I think we have to say that as a subroutine, selfing is actually a pretty good idea. You've got to be an agent in this world in order to grow up, get a job, and carry on your life. So selfing, as being an agent of action, is a decent idea. Being trapped in self is not so hot. But so you need a coherence of person, and a coherence of person as you are biologically, with a good deal of compassion for who you are, in order to be able to relax this. There are some things in here. People who have dissociative disorders, who tend to, as somebody said in one of the questions today, have a traumatic experience and fly away into dissociate from it. This whole thing of you have to bring the self back in order then to work with it in such a way as that you can go to and use the self skillfully. Ultimately, the Buddha and most of our teachings are all about skillful means. They're all about being able to use your brain to foster your benefits, to foster the health of others and yourself. And so, again, being with yourself. If you are an individual who has a tendency for dissociative disorder, has a tendency to be loosely structured. Throwing yourself away is a baby bathwater issue. And it's, you actually need to, that in that case, I would probably not recommend that you spend a great deal of time deconstructing the self. And I would tend to say other practices within the Buddhist, you know, collection of practices would be more successful in terms of getting you down the road. And ultimately, to distinguish between the person, which is the body-mind as a whole. The body-mind is that entity that comes up again, has contact with the universe and then acts on it. And the apparent self, which is this thing that, you know, supposedly unified, stable, independent. To distinguish it, I mean, I like to be able to distinguish between this person and the apparent self is ultimately where we're going. In my own view, I sort of think of the this apparent self as a multicentric subroutine, and it's just a subroutine in the system that's processing data and says, okay, this is attached to this body, and this is not, and it's a very useful subroutine in terms of what it does. And the whole aim of this is to enjoy the peace of less selfing down the road. So, how do we use mindfulness? Mindfulness is a practice that we actually didn't train you in today. There are other seminars that are focused much more on that, but it's actually basically bringing the attention to events as they arise in your space of awareness. And going through your life, notice how little I there is in many activities. Rick has talked about this earlier, but, you know, reaching for the salt shaker, cuddling, and take in that sense of minimal selfing combined with life being okay. I actually wanted to put one in here, which you guys will all experience on the way home, which is driving meditation. And Shin Zen Young, who was my first meditation teacher, you know, and that was in Los Angeles, where, you know, most people spend a great deal of their lives staring at headlights and being traffic. So notice, as you drive home tonight, as you skillfully drive home tonight, with care and compassion for yourself and everybody else, how little I, me, is there. And just like as you are standing here and looking into the eyes of the other, how that red set of headlights in front of you that's suddenly slowing down brings self right up front high. It's an excellent way to actually just weave an active meditation practice that's meditation in action into your day-to-day life and carry it forward. And you can watch self arise and fall as you are making your appointment, late for your appointment, traffic is happening, you know, stuff is happening in the lane next to you. Is this guy going to come over and hit me or not? Or I've got this beautiful, long, empty freeway ahead of me with nobody on it. You know, and I'm going 75 miles an hour, and I notice exactly how many times I pick up black and white cop cars, right? Out of the corner of my vision. Boom! Don't even know they were there until I drove by. So there's a lot that you can watch I arise and fall in a very skillful fashion doing just any kind of activity during the day. So, and the things that bring I forward, threats, opportunities, contact. So it's a process rather than as a being. It shows up in a sense when a decision kind of needs to be made about what to do about this next mind moment. And it's a useful thing to have. And like people have said about meditation, mind is a great servant but a terrible master. Self is a great servant but a terrible master. So the idea is to put self back in on the servant side of your own personhood. Wherever you are during the period of time, focus on present moment experience as a process. This is very difficult to do as you're kind of going through the day because there'll be all kinds of distractions. But take 5-10 minutes during the day of a period of time that you otherwise would not do. You know, take some time at work and just watch the present moment stuff as a process happen. and how, you know, threats, opportunities, contact with others, you know, in your work environment creates all kinds of self, and self comes and goes and comes and goes. And dependent upon, you know, and then you go back to, typing, in my case, typing an entry into the patient's chart and just kind of doing it sort of by rote, and I know that this is the kind of text that needs to go in there, and I drop away, and I'm just kind of, you know, and the typing subroutine kicks in, and I'm actually sometimes even thinking about something else. Notice when you're thinking about something else as you're doing some of your work activities, and notice what happens. Who's the self, and where'd the self go on that one? And be mindful, every time you get a mini movie running in your mind, notice where you are as the protagonist. You know, is this grand opera? I mean, are you doing Carmen? Are you doing Cho-Cho-San or Madame Butterfly? You know? Sepulchre. That thing where the movie is running and there's a plot line is a real indicator that you've moved out of lateral processing and you're beginning to run this limbic mesial structures. And the other thing, the paranoid moment at the bottom of the slide. I love it. Beware presuming that others are intentionally targeting you. Which my sardonic side, since we always have to have, since somebody said the yes buts earlier today. Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you. But that presumption, I talked a little bit about the mirror neuronal system a little earlier in terms of humans. If you are sitting in the place of thinking that you are being targeted, then what is being read 100 feet away by somebody looking at you is you being targeted behavior. You can't keep it off your face. I mean, this is kind of programmed facial expression that happens so fast that it's very, very difficult to catch, and yet it is subliminally showing up in other people, and they will essentially begin to react. So you literally, in this thing with these mini movies and with all this sort of self and our self stories, we create in the other the things that control and reinforce and continue this story we have told ourselves. We're no longer in the moment. We're in this war and peace history that we've written about ourselves, and we proceed to read and read and read and read and read again. So those are some of the ways that, in being very mindful of what is going on with you minute by minute, and training yourself in these actions over weeks and months, you can actually free up a lot of your neuronal energy, your neuronal real estate, to be more available to what is happening right now, and will actually, in terms of who you will start behaving as, become much more of a compassionate, opening, and caring human being. Even if you don't think so inside, it will start happening, and then interestingly enough, you will begin to see yourself out there, mirrored back. So this is it's a feed-forward loop, and I think it's something that has a lot of juice to it in terms of a practice.
Do you mind if I add one?
Please.
A small thing is that the Buddha had this, to me, lovely phrase, give no being cause to fear you. And he didn't say, don't give beings, you know, no cause to expect that they won't get dessert if they fail to do their homework. Right? In other words, there's a place for doing things that create expectations for others, that support our own boundaries and our own needs. But to not approach life, you know, with the fist, but rather with the open hand, not giving beings cause to fear us. And it's interesting that as we approach the world with some sort of sustained benevolence, while realizing that, of course, we need to protect and refuel ourselves to be able to sustain that, as we do that, interestingly, other people gradually, not perfectly, but generally, target us less. And as they target us less, and as we approach them benevolently, we tend to presume a benevolence in turn. That then really tends to undermine the activation of, are you looking at me? You know, did you do that to me? Or why'd they pick on me? You know, et cetera, et cetera. So this last one down there, you know, is actually really quite powerful, because one of the stronger things that tends to activate self, right,
right,
is the sense that others are doing it personally, that they're going after me or you personally. So that's the last one. You know, there's a lovely metaphor. We use it in our book about the parable of the log. It's the idea that, you know, in life, imagine you're in a canoe with your sweetie or a friend, and it's Sunday, it's picnic, you're dressed up real nice, got Grandma Silver with you in the canoe, and suddenly there's a loud thump against the side of the canoe, you're tipped over, dumped into the river, you come up sputtering, what do you see? Two people have, you know, snuck up on you with goggles and snorkels and face masks and flippers, and they flipped over the canoe and they're laughing and laughing. How do you feel? Fair amount of self, huh, right? Okay. Now take two, doing
this
quick
break. Let alone Grandma Silver.
All right, yeah. So same thing, Sunday, river, canoe, everything's great, loud thump on the side of the canoe, dumped into the river, come up sputtering, Grandma Silver at the bottom, lost forever. What do you see? You see a large submerged log has drifted downstream and smacked into you. How do you feel? Same event, same first dart in the Buddhist metaphor of the loss, the cold, the shock, and all the rest of that. But the meaning of the event, the attribution, mm-hmm. that's the word in psychology, the attribution of intentionality to the other person, what we attribute to them, that's really different, isn't it? And we see that we're on the receiving end of a unfortunate, unpleasant, impersonal process. It began upstream a long time ago, right? 10,000 causes led to that log at this moment smacking into this canoe on this day. But it doesn't have to be about I, right? And the truth is, most people bumping into us are like logs. They were launched through 10,000 causes upstream of them last lifetime, you know, their parents' generation and their parents' parents and all the rest of that. You know, get out of the way of the logs. Right. Or recover if we've been smacked. Hey, find a new river. With fewer logs, perhaps. Right? But we don't have to always take it so personally. So that's that bit there.
I actually have one little other piece to that, which is the last time I recalled that story, I recalled it in three parts. And the first was the guys with the snorkel, who obviously were 15. And the second was the dead log. And then the third way I recalled it was a canoe carrying a 60-year-old man who was having a heart attack and had lost control of his paddle. And here you're thrown. And what's your response to that? The dude is having a cardiac arrest. And, you know, that which flipped me into the compassion piece of here are all these people being logs with all of their launching when what's happening is that their own heart's breaking. And what is, you know, where do you go with that? And that's another piece to take that. Okay.
Bahia? Yeah, can you take us out?
Let's go right to the Bahia Sutta.